Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, our guest is Zachary Thomas Dodson, author of Bats of the Republic, an illuminated novel. It was published this past October by Doubleday. Zachary is as much designer as author and founded Featherproof Books in Chicago in 2005. He also teaches courses on hybrid narrative and storytelling at Aalto University in Helsinki. Bats of the Republic, and for that matter, any other book designed and published by Featherproof, are visual and tactile delights. Go to Zachary's website, and you can take a look at some of them, or go to his really funny self-interview, or go to the YouTube summary of the book that he gives. So Bats is a feast for the eyes with a reversible dust jacket, maps, foldouts, burn holes, wormholes, and a super scary secret envelope that you should never, ever open until the end, if and when you get there. Zachary is not against the digital revolution in books. In fact, the book is available electronically. But what he has done is save a format, the idea of holding the author's soul, if you will, in your hand as you read, the idea of visualizing the world and not just the words behind a story or an imagined universe. Thus, even in the 21st century, we can be spirited away in a multi-sensory way to lands that we can only dream of, or maybe, because of the way the book is designed, lands that we couldn't even dream of. Bats is such a novel. Set in 19th century Texas and in a dystopic parallel American future, the book veers between those parallel storylines and convoluted and illuminated by illustrations, telegrams, and a novel within a novel. I may be making this all seem as if it's unreadable, but quite the contrary. It's almost as if you have your own Virgil kind of leading you along, making sure you don't make a wrong turn. And with that, welcome, Zachary, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So I love epigraphs, and here you have three, and I'm delighted that you also have three postgraphs as well. So the first epigraph you have is from a beautiful song called Wax Wings. Tell me a little bit about that and how that came about. And I was a little curious as how you decided that that would be the way you would lead off your book.
Yeah, I love that song. It's by a Scottish musician named Alistair Roberts, who's on Drag City Records. And that song, or I guess a lot of his songs, are kind of concerned with heritage. I mean, not only familial heritage, but also cultural heritage. You know, he sings in kind of the Scottish folk tradition, or even, I guess, the larger sort of English and Welsh and Scottish folk traditions. But then, you know, inserts himself or kind of does his own versions of folk songs, or kind of makes up his own traditional songs in a way. So that song in particular sort of alludes to that linkage with past generations while using the metaphor of flight and wings, which seemed appropriate for the book.
Yeah, as did the quote from Joanna Newsom, who I don't find as accessible as Alistair, but yeah, that's that. And then the third one reminds me of my grandfather as well, where he simply said, "I'm not happy."
Yes, this was, my grandfather was very funny, and that was kind of one of his things that he would say just at random. it was something of a joke and something of the truth, and yeah, very funny to me.
And you bookend, literally and figuratively, with a potential grandson of yours saying, "Who are you anyway?" And that's very much what, you know, I'm 63 years old and I have two grandchildren, and they may not know who I am depending on when I go to some other place. And it's interesting to think about that and memory. And that ties in with the book nicely, too. And then the first of the postscripts is from the Bene Gesserit witch, Jessica, in Dune. The night is a tunnel, she thought, a hole into tomorrow. Which goes into the same kind of thought process, I think.
Yeah, and again, I think those are some metaphors that operate in the book, but Dune I just love, and I pulled a lot from different classic sci-fi, but Dune is one of my favorite, and the Bene Gesserit have always been sort of compelling to me. So
Yeah.
They appear there in a form, in a disguised form.
Yeah, like when Muad'Dib puts his hand in the box, you know, and he thinks, that was a great scene. You know, the box
yeah,
with his
yeah.
hand is going to be burnt up. And then the second one is by the guy who wrote Aeon Flux. And I don't know if you know him or not, but I was just surprised that you stuck that in there too.
I don't know him, but I know Aeon Flux very well, and that cartoon series was a big influence on the book. I just love the way that he kind of creates these really complex, interconnected worlds, and then hardly bothers to explain them. You just kind of rush headlong and get information from all sorts of directions, visual information, narrative information, philosophy, and just in a really heady mix. They seem like juvenilia, you know, that it's like kind of bondage superhero spy on the surface glance, but underneath it, the way that those are written, both in terms of dialogue and the plots, are astounding to me.
I even like the movie, but only because I like Charlize Theron so much.
Oh, sure, yeah. I was disappointed in the
movie.
Yeah,
I know.
But
so was I, but I still like her.
Sure.
So I really didn't know where to start, so I have a bunch of questions, but I'll ask, why did you choose steampunk to portray the future world constrained and dystopic as it is?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't think of it as steampunk exactly. More there's, you know, kind of some nods to steampunk throughout. But I really do like the idea in steampunk of a bit of future in the past, or a bit of the past in the future, whichever way you want to look at it. And, you know, that's something that the book is concerned with, the past and the future, and what continues and what connects. And so, it seemed appropriate to have a future that could also be in the past, or that also had things from the past. So I think that's what steampunk is doing. And so I put my own little winks to steampunk in there.
Yeah, and especially like with that diagram of the steam saber, which I liked a lot.
Yeah, that was fun. I'm not a very athletic person, but the one sport that I do is fencing, so I had to get a little bit of fencing in there.
That's a great sport to do if you're going to choose one.
It's fun.
So next question, which is arbitrary, which I might know the answer to, is why Texas? I think I know the answer to it, but go ahead.
Yeah, that Texas is my my home country. and I say country because that's kind of how Texans think of themselves, and certainly when you're in Texas, it can feel that way. So I haven't lived there for many years, but of course, being born there and growing up there, I have an affinity with it. And in elementary school in Texas, elementary and middle school, you're taught a year of American history, and then a year of Texas history, and then a year of American, and then a year of Texas. So in my childhood mind, Texas and the U.S. were about of equal import. And it wasn't until I got outside of Texas that I realized that, okay, maybe it's just Texas that is so concerned with its own history and the Alamo and the Revolution and stuff like that. So I don't know, having all that stuff in my head, I kind of wanted to exercise it a bit.
Yeah, it's like Jupiter. Like Jupiter is so massive, it's just about massive enough to turn into a star, but it doesn't. So that's how I feel about the Republic of Texas.
exactly. And I also wanted to portray the sort of strange Texas that I know, which is more West Texas. I grew up in El Paso, so this is the desert Southwest, and really is not very much like the rest of Texas. And so, like you say about Jupiter, Texas is big enough to contain multitudes, and I felt that was an unseen part of Texas that I wanted to bring to light.
And even the way you portray yourself, like the picture of you on the dust jacket, looks like you could easily come out of a Quentin Tarantino movie about Texas or something like that. And then on the inside of the jacket, where you look completely whacked. Yeah, but the first one, it looks like you could actually be from Texas, especially because of the mustache, obviously.
Yeah, well, it's funny. My wife makes fun of how many pictures there are of me in the book, and you know how that feeds into the the ego sort of self-obsessed project that writing a book is. But I don't mind playing a character, and I think that in some ways, author photos always, for me anyway, kind of veer towards that.
Yeah. It's funny, they used to have this test, you know, with tons of questions about how to determine if you're a narcissist or not. And then I read this article, the new test is this one question. You ask the person, are you a narcissist? And if they say yes, then they are.
I like that.
So yeah, I could tell.
I think I would pass that test.
Me too. Well, the next arbitrary question is, why bats?
Yes, well, so that ties into the desert Southwest. When I was a kid, there was a giant bat cavern not too far from El Paso, and we would go there sometimes and watch the bats emerge at dusk. And it's just this beautiful experience, just a tornado of bats coming out of the ground, sort of spiraling up above your head. And it's not scary at all. They don't care about humans, and they don't screech like in the movies. It sounds more like a waterfall. So it's really this peaceful, beautiful thing. And within a few minutes, you know, all the mosquito bites cease. So they're taking all the insects out of the air. And it's just such a cool thing. And bats are so misunderstood that I wanted also to portray them in a different light.
Yeah, I agree with you totally. I went to the University of Florida, and they built this gigantic bat house.
And
it was nice to just sit there at night and just watch it happen, just like you said. And the waterfall metaphor is really good too, because it is one of the nicest sounds you can hear.
Yeah, they're really quiet. And then when you read about them more, I mean, they're very intelligent and fascinating creatures, one of the most diverse mammal species, with all sorts of ecological benefits. And I read a ton about bats while researching this book, and then it ended up I could put hardly any of it in because my character is in 1840, so what could he really know about bats other than what he could see? So there, you know, I kind of didn't get to talk about echolocation or all of the strange other things that bats do.
Yeah, and I was going to mention in the at the very end of the book, that picture of the office, is that your office with all the bottles there?
That is. Or it was my desk at the time that I started the book. So the book took 7 years, so that desk is long gone.
Are you an alcoholic?
No, but I just get the bottles around for some reason, aesthetics reason.
But I just happened to glance at this, but what I was going to ask about was at the end is you talk about white nose syndrome in bats. Why don't you just mention that since, you know, it's important to you?
Yeah, I do think it's important, and I think that it's that's what's happening to bats now, is this terrible disease that's sort of decimating populations. In the U.S., I mean, really decimating. The caves that it hits have a mortality rate sometimes approaching 100%. So it's kind of like the colony collapse of bees, and
right,
has a similar, really kind of dire ecological impact because bats pollinate so much and destroy so many pests, for agriculture. It means that we don't have to put more pesticides into the environment if we have a healthy bat population. But because bats are misunderstood and much maligned, then the efforts to sort of help the bat population combat this terrible disease are really underserved. And Bat Conservation International, who's doing a lot to fight white nose syndrome, really needs all the help they can get to combat a huge, I mean, I would call it the biggest ecological, or one of the biggest ecological disasters happening at the moment.
Yeah, between bees and bats, it pretty much busts our ecosystem pretty well if they go away.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, before I read about it, I didn't know either. People have a not much of an understanding of how important certain things are to the ecosystem and how fragile the whole thing really kind of is.
Yeah, I know. I never really realized it. You know, I never really understood what an ecosystem was until I went to Costa Rica and we went on a night tour of the rainforest. And I realized it was almost like, it sounds silly, but it was like Avatar. And you could see how everything depended on everything else. And it was just so clear. And it had never been clear to me before. And it was also clear that if you take out one of those things, then things either collapse or come close to collapsing. But I never had that understanding until that moment. Now I do.
Yeah, sure. Costa Rica is beautiful.
It is. And the organization that you alluded to in the book is batcon.org, so I guess people could go to that and check it out. So
I encourage people to read more about bats.
I will. So the other one is, like, this is the biggest spoiler of all time, so obviously I can't say it, but why the letter? Why did you choose to... I mean, it's really funny and it's really tantalizing. And in your little video, you talk about, whatever you do, don't open the letter. Where did that come from? And why did you choose to use this do not open forbidden context of a document that couldn't be read until the book was completed?
Sure. Well, it's a bit of a tease, you know, and... But I kind of liked that idea. I kind of liked the idea of readers being tempted to open this, physical letter that's at the back of the book while they're reading. And it wasn't until people started reading it and I started getting reactions that I really realized people really can open it at any point. And different people choose different points to do that, which is fascinating to me. So now my first question is usually, well, when did you open the letter? But for me, it was also a thing that harkens to the book as a physical object, something that you can do in paper form, you can do in a book that you can't do in digital form. Kind of playing with that idea are those readers who turn to the last page and like to peek at the end.
I was just going to ask you about that. Do you know anyone who does that? I think that's horrible. I hate when people do that.
Yeah. It's funny. I don't do that, but I can understand the habit. And for some people, maybe the plot isn't the most important thing or something. I'm not sure what drives that, but I like it. I like making it just a little more difficult for those people.
Yeah, you did. Well, yeah, and the thing that's interesting about your book and a lot of the books that Featherproof publishes is that it's hard to determine, although I don't know whether it's necessary, to determine how much of your work is plot-driven or design-driven. And the envelope contains both elements of that.
Sure. Yeah. And I guess I try not to think of them separately too much. I want the design to do some of that plot work, some of the storytelling work. Ultimately, though, for me, I think the story is the most important. There's no point to the words or to the design if the story isn't interesting itself. So I worked hard to try and make a good story.
It's funny, they have this, new, for want of a better word, genre called ergodic literature, which includes books like S, which is a really cool book, or House of Leaves, or Cloud Atlas, or back in the day, maybe Infinite Jest even. But it's interesting because the idea of ergodic literature, I think, is that it's defined as it's a non-trivial task for the reader to complete the work. And I kind of like that, but I kind of don't. But it's true in a way. You are requiring, if someone wants to successfully complete your work, you're requiring the reader to actually invest in the work. And I think that's what's cool about the genre, if indeed you consider it a genre.
Yeah, I think that yeah, you know, not to comment on genre or anything, but I do think that with a book like that that asks more of the reader, I think then the onus is on the author to make that pay off too, right? If you're going to ask more work, I think there should be a payoff. And it's not for everybody. Some people like that kind of book or that kind of project. Some people like puzzles. Some people don't like puzzles, you know? So it's about whether you like figuring something out or whether you just want to have an experience. So, yeah, I don't think I asked as much as S. But
now, S is like, once you get the ball rolling, you can kind of like, you can kind of, but especially with the different color inks. But it was tough, but it was beautiful. And
it was. The production was really nice.
Yeah, it's funny because we were talking about before the show about, you know, that I have the book and I also downloaded it just as an experiment. And it's funny, when you're reading it on my iPad, it's easier. It's easier to do. And But I don't know if you get the same. But then when you flip back to the book, it seems like you're, like I said at the beginning, you're more inside. You're outside when you're reading on the iPad, but when you're, whatever you're doing with the book, you're more inside. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that perspective before. Yeah, I mean, it's meant to be a physical book. I really designed it as a print object. But like you said, I'm not against the digital at all. And they did a good job converting it into the ebook, which is an awkward format, I think. But ebook or enhanced book or any kind of storytelling in the digital realm, I think there's a long way to go. I mean, I think there's a lot to be done, and I'm excited with the potential of that medium.
Yeah, it's like driverless cars. You know, it's in its infancy, but eventually that's what we'll be doing. But
Yeah, or we'll be doing both. You know, I think I think print books have a long way to go too. There's stuff to be done in print that hasn't been done, and some of the books you mentioned are starting to do those things. So that's also exciting to me.
Well, that one book that you designed, Daddies, and on your page you have pictures of it. That's a I need to get that because it's fascinating. I mean, that was a lot of work for you.
Sure, it was a lot of fun. I mean, I have a lot of fun doing it. Lindsay Hunter wrote that. It's her first book, and it's great. Her stories are very short, just a page or two sometimes, but they're these wicked little hooks. And so we kind of chose the metaphor of a tackle box, which has all these tiny compartments full of either disgusting or barbed things. So it seemed to work for that book. But her writing is phenomenal, just electric.
It's funny because, like, I read something by her or something, like, I think Viral or some other short story books, and I think, wow, this is really great. But then I have this bookstore and these, you know, women come in who are reading Jodi Picoult or something like that. And I say, here's this great book you should read. And then they come back and they're disgusted. And they give it, how dare you? Why would you give me this book? But I just, yeah. I lose sight of the fact that just because I loved it doesn't mean they're going to like it at all. And
Sure. Well, it's funny that way, you know, and I feel like those are the reactions to Lindsay's writing. It's either, oh, this is the most phenomenal thing I've ever read, or this is absolutely disgusting. And I think both indicate success.
I agree, totally. Yeah, if you can elicit an emotional response of any kind from simply putting ink on a piece of paper, yeah, I think that's pretty darn good. Speaking of which, where did the Sisters Gray come from? And so this is the part that's the novel within the novel. And what's interesting is one of the reviews says you kind of bust the fourth wall because you complain about the Sisters Gray novels being kind of like supercilious. I thought that was interesting how you chose to do that, because both inform the other, which, it is kind of complicated. You know, the way we're talking about it, it does seem like it's like one of the reviews said, like a Mobius strip.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to tuck the stories inside one another. The Sisters Gray, you know, I'd written the part where the part set in the past where Zadok travels down to Texas in the 1840s. And then I kind of started to wonder what this woman that he's in love with was doing back home. And originally I just meant to write a short scene or two about that. And then it just kind of kept going and turned into a whole sort of mini novel of its own. So yeah, that's kind of written in the style of a Victorian era novel, which that breaking of the fourth wall sort of speaks to my self-consciousness about.
Yeah, it definitely does. So when you do like the sketches you do of buildings or animals or the handwritten love notes or pamphlets or maps, when you complete something like that, you know, because you're married and you have kids, do you ever go and say, hey, look what I just did. Look at this picture of this bat. Or look at this. Do you ever get like so excited because you really think it's cool that you're going to stick that in the right page?
I do. The design part is really fun for me. And you know, some of it was very spontaneous. I'd be writing and then, you know, there'd be a telegram in the story and I'd say, oh, well, you know, I can make that telegram. And it's very satisfying because something like that I can complete in an afternoon and feel happy with how it looks, whereas writing the novel, writing the text itself took many years and a lot of hand-wringing and editing and changing, and doesn't have quite that easy satisfaction that making a drawing sometimes can.
Do you have a drafting table you use when you're doing all the artwork kind of part of it?
No, well, the animals themselves were drawn in the Field Museum in Chicago. So I would go and I would sit in front of a stuffed buffalo or a coyote or whatever Southwest animal and spend a few hours trying to draw it. And actually, those were sometimes frustrating because I'm not the best draftsman, but then I told myself, well, you know, neither is my character then. He's kind of a poor illustrator, so these can be what they are. But I drew them from life or from still life or from taxidermied life. That's a thing.
When you decided to do that the self-interview, which, as I said earlier, was hilarious and it's very self-deprecating, that was interesting. That was just like an afterthought and you just thought it was really funny, because it is really funny.
Yeah, that was just a fun thing for the Nervous Breakdown. They have this series of self-interviews, and which is a great idea, you know. And it's a little puzzle, right? How do you interview yourself? So, since my shtick is design, I figured I would use diagrams.
Yeah, and at first I looked and I said, "This doesn't make any sense," and then I realized, "Oh yeah, it makes perfect sense." I guess one of the last questions I was going to ask you is, you know, and you talked about it a little bit, but, and because, you know, it's it can't sell millions and millions of copies because it's so lavish, but it can be very popular, but it can't be like 50 Shades of Grey, thank God. Do you really derive it? I assume you derive an enormous amount of pleasure because you're investing, as you said, years of time to do this. And with Featherproof, I think it seems as if it's not motivated by money.
No, it's not. You're right. These aren't kind of paperback bestsellers that a printer could just churn out. It takes a little more time and craft, certainly, even on the printing end, to produce these things. But I guess I'm not really thinking about that. What I'm thinking about when I make the design for this book or for any of the Featherproof books is kind of, how can a book be more like itself, or how can the form or the object of the book start to play with the story, start to play with the writing and the content, in a way that makes the book become itself. I don't know a better way to put that.
No, it's kind of the same way I put it, I think, before.
Yeah. So that's why. That's why sometimes these printing techniques seem to fit.
I wonder if anyone will ever put smell into books, because, like, because I think smell is like the most evocative of all the senses. Like, if I smell burning leaves, I think of, you know, being 11 years old and Halloween, and, you know, I can see my street and all those kinds of things. I mean, it would be. But you did say it's still developing, so it's possible, I guess.
That's a great idea. I mean, I think there's, you know, scratch and sniff for kids, we've yet to have the literary fiction kind of serious tome version of scratch and sniff, but I think that would be fantastic.
Yeah, because there really is. You're right. No pun intended. You're just scratching the surface. There's lots of other things you can do. So, what's your next? What do you have on tap now? Either Featherproof or on your own?
Yes, well, both. So Featherproof, you know, I'm designing the books, but the publisher is now Tim Kinsella. So he's coming out with some great books. See You in the Morning by Mairead Case just came out this fall. There's one coming in the spring called Tennessee Highway Death Chant that's got great language. So working on designing those books, and then I've started to write another one myself, and I'm not sure what that will be yet. I've just kind of waded into it, but I've been reading about pyramids and the moon, and I'm in Finland. I live in Helsinki now, so I've been reading the Finnish national epic, which is called the Kalevala. And that's fascinating. So that's kind of what's brewing in my head, but we'll see what comes of it.
What is it, like 9 o'clock at night there?
It is, yeah. It's about 9, which means it's been dark for 5 or 6 hours now.
That's what I was going to ask you. I mean, and how are you, why are you there?
So I took a job at Aalto University, which is an art and design school here, teaching stuff like this book, visual narrative, so storytelling in visual form, whether that's graphic novels or animation or games or books that use visuals and design to tell stories.
Well, in conclusion, it's definitely, and I don't say this because they aren't, this is a unique book, and I think for those who are, and if you've read S, or if you've read House of Leaves, or any of David Foster Wallace's stuff, this is like the kind of perfect thing to read. The only problem is it's one of those books, like, I kind of wish I was sick and in bed for a week so that I could read it. Because I think the reader is invested, as invested in this book as the writer is. I don't know if you feel the same way. And also, I don't know whether you feel like, hey, when I let this book go out into the world, am I letting my firstborn son out there? Do you feel like you've let it go and you kind of want it back, or are you happy to let it go to the readers?
Oh, I'm happy to let it go. It's funny. There was a point, you know, I really enjoyed working on it. And, of course, publication is the end of that, which is a double-edged sword. So there was a point where I thought, well, maybe I should just continue to work on this book for the rest of my life and never worry about publication. So, you know, so I'll have a hobby. But no, I was really relieved to finish it. Like I said, it was 7 years. So I'm really happy to have it out and have it printed in the form that I wanted it to be printed in. And thank you for the kind words about it. I don't want anyone to be sick, but maybe, you know, you can pretend and just stay in bed for a week.
Yeah,
that'd be acceptable.
Well, it's kind of, maybe pissed off at you because you made me, you know, stay up really late, and then in the morning I'm really tired and I have to take the kids to school, and it's, you know, it's kind of a pain in the ass.
Well, I'm sorry, and I can sympathize. If it makes you feel any better, I have jet lag, and it's, you know, completely dark here all the time.
That's
so
true.
I'm a bit of a zombie myself.
It's true. Well, it was a pleasure talking to you. I would recommend this book for pretty much anybody, and I would strongly recommend going to Featherproof. And then, hey, what's the best way for me to tell people to get these books? Because it's hard for me to get them through outlets like Baker and Taylor and even Amazon. So how do people best acquire a Featherproof book?
The best way is order off the website, which is featherproof.com. And I guess the second way I would say is if you have a local independent bookstore, to order through your bookstore and support that community endeavor.
Thank you very much for that plug. I appreciate it. So,
yeah, sure.
In any event, it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us here today on The Avid Reader. That was Zachary Dodson, Zachary Thomas Dodson, author of Bath of the Republic, an illuminated novel. Just go to a site, go to Featherproof. You'll be amazed when you look at some of the books that Featherproof does. I have never seen anything like it. And there's, like I said, it's this new genre. And I don't like labeling things, but they are books that, like this one S, is really cool. It looks like a library book. It even has a library book label on it. And it's even called Ship of Theseus. So it's like a fake novel. And in the margins, this girl and boy are writing letters back to each other. They fall in love, and then there's this mystery. But it's all around the book. So you have to read it like four or five times, and then the ink's in different colors so you know when they're writing what. It's hard to explain, but it's really, really good. So let's see, what do we got? We have Stephen Harrigan coming. Yeah, he'll be coming at President's Day, and the book is A Friend of Lincoln, so that's appropriate. And then Giles Milton, who wrote this really cool book. It's called When Hitler Did Cocaine and Lenin Lost His Brain. And what it is it's anecdotes, footnotes, marginalia to history, things that don't necessarily come up in a history book, but things like the fact that Hitler was prescribed by this quack doctor 80 drugs a day, including amphetamines, cocaine, testosterone before he would go to bed with Eva Braun. So it's like, did this affect the course of World War II? Apparently there was a meeting with Mussolini when he was trying to get Mussolini not to switch sides, where he went berserk, and it was due to the fact that this guy kept injecting him with stuff. And there's all kinds of anecdotes like that in the story. Plus there's cannibalism, which is always a pleasure. And Lawrence Hill will be also with us. So for a complete schedule, you can visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com or simply download our podcast at iTunes or Podomatic. Okay, so thanks, and join us next week on The Avid Reader.